Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the barrister and businesswoman Heather Rabatz. It would be fair to describe her as someone who likes a challenge. From Millwall Football Club to the Royal Opera House, she has a talent for turning a crisis into an opportunity, which came in handy when she took over running the chronically dysfunctional Lambeth Council in the mid-90s. 10,000 staff, a £900 million turnover, and even the advertisement in the paper touting for candidates said it was probably the worst job in local government. Born in Jamaica and brought up in Britain, she left school with just a couple of O-levels. Her teacher said if she was lucky, she might work in a shop. She says life is to be lived. I've always enjoyed standing on the edge and taking risks. So, Heather Rabatz, standing on the edge and taking risks, and I'm imagining being in charge. You enjoy that too?
I definitely like being in charge, and I've always felt that I can gather everybody's spirits and energies to take that jump into the unknown together. And that's what I've enjoyed across all the different sectors I've been lucky enough to work in.
Yeah, so in your time, you have been a governor at the BBC and at the London School of Economics. And of course, there's no point in quoting the figures because everybody knows that most boardrooms in Britain are still male-dominated and still white. How have you found them as environments to work in?
They've all had their unique and different challenges, and I still feel after all these years that women's voice, obviously not least in football, is still pretty rare. I think I have worked with some incredibly talented people, however, and you learn to navigate the politics across the boardroom table, and that's what I've done wherever I have been.
You're being very nice and very positive. Exactly as I would expect from somebody who's held the positions you have. But I'm thinking practically. Can you give me an illustration of the kind of thing where you thought, this guy's just really not listening to me?
There probably have been too many instances of when you've sat round a table and you've made a comment and you realise that you've just been ignored. There were certainly, in the world of football, certain characters who would definitely ignore and not even listen to what you were saying. When you go into a boardroom as a woman, I think the big difference is that you always have to win the approval and respect of the people around that table. If you're a man, it's accorded to you automatically. And it doesn't matter how much experience you have, you always have to do it.
And you're not a blender in. I mean, you are, I'm imagining it, you know, everybody makes choices about how they look. You are flamboyant. I mean, today, you know, you're wearing a very sort of chic sheath dress and matching coat in black, but around that are very dangly earrings, lots of jewellery on the wrists. You want people to say,
yes,
take a look at me.
I've never wanted to be nice, because nice is about blending into the wallpaper. And I suppose because I was this young mixed race girl in a very white area, I couldn't blend in. And actually, I made the decision, I am going to just stand out more. And that's partly how I used to defend myself in terms of dealing with the sort of school playground bullies. And actually that sense of being flamboyant, going back to the conversation about boardrooms, it sort of disarms people. If people can't put you in that pigeonhole, that's one of the ways that you get your voice heard around those very male-dominated arenas.
And what about at home? Do you take your foot off the gas? Are you laid back and relaxed? Do you sort of let the weekends float by in a haze of inefficiency?
Increasingly so. Certainly my family would definitely, when they open the fridge and there is no food, say clearly the inefficiency has risen to yet another level.
To the music then, Heather Rabatz. Tell me about the first disc that we're going to hear today.
Well, I recently saw Carine Bailey-Ray in concert, and she's just a stunning performer. She's this mixed race, really talented young woman from Leeds. And she sang this song, Que Sera Sera, which my mum used to play for me as a little girl, which was really, none of us knows what the future is going to be. So live your life, live every day. And I was utterly surprised when she came on and sang this song of my childhood, but in her voice. It was just a brilliant moment.
And I was just a little girl. I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Is what she said to me.
That was Corinne Bailey-Ray with John McCullum and Que Sera Sera. So, Heather Rabatz, your career spans so many industries. There's TV, the arts, transport, education, banking. It would be impossible for anybody to have knowledge in all these different areas. Do you think a sort of a lack of first-hand experience ever makes you anxious about what you can bring to the boardroom table?
Yes, it does. There's always that moment which is, have I just taken one step too far in my risk-taking ambition? But what I always hold fast to is actually that there will be many experts around the table. At the moment, I'm involved with Crossrail and digging a new tunnel underneath some unbelievable central London architecture. There are the most brilliant engineers. That's not my task.
Right.
And it isn't about being the engineer. It is about understanding how all of those bits fit together to make the overall project, whatever that project might be, work.
I want to talk about your two sort of most prominent roles, running Lambeth and then Millwall, in a little bit more detail later on. But I'm wondering, when you look back on them, given that they were, I imagine, the toughest posts, are they the ones that you look back on with the greatest fondness?
I think I do, actually. I think I do. They so powerfully shaped me, and the people I met and worked with were really wonderful. Despite brands and reputations, there are always great people in organisations. And therefore, yes, I think I probably do look at them both with joy, actually.
And have you ever been in an organisation where you've thought the sheer torpor that it's operating under is so great that I actually, do you know what, I'm not up to the job?
I've never found that sense of torpor one that's led me to think I can't do this. It's actually revealed what do I need to do to create energy. And what I usually do in those situations is drive people in a way they've never been driven before.
And so, and obviously there have been times when you've gotten rid of great chunks of people from organisations.
Yes.
Do you go at such a pace that you just watch them fall away, or is it literally the case, well, it must be, I suppose, quite often with people at a very high level, come into my office, I need to talk to you.
I mean, I was called the Terminator in part of my career because so many people left, in this instance, Lambeth. And I think it's a mix. There's your very senior officers who you come to a view that we can't go on this journey together. You're either haven't got the skill set or the experience, or you're in such opposition to me that we're not going to make this work. It's never easy. I've always found it hard. People are angry, they're upset. And I think how you treat people in their moments of exit is hugely important, not only for them, for you, but also for the rest of the organisation. So the maintenance of humanity, I think, for me, is part of a key criteria of being a leader in any organisation. But you can't shy away from it. My advice is always to act decisively, because then people will make the adjustments.
Over the years, in the many different roles that you've had, do you know how many people you have sat down with, personally, I'm talking about one-to-one, and said, it's time for you to go?
Oh, gosh. I've probably done it in over 100, 150 instances. It's been a lot.
Time for some music. What's next then, Heather?
Well, it's Bob Dylan. This is a song that will remind me of growing up, and my sister. We shared a bedroom together for our first 16 years of our lives, and she loved the Stones and Beatles and Dylan, and I certainly love this particular track.
All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
That was Bob Dylan and All Along the Watchtower. So, Heather, let's find out where this organisational flair sprang from then. You were born in Jamaica. It was 1955, wasn't
yes.
it? How many years did you spend in Jamaica?
Hardly any. We came over here as young toddlers, as a family. I was just about 3 years old when we arrived.
So you probably have... Do you have some memories of Jamaica?
I do have some memories. And in many ways, I have memories of Jamaica because my mum talked about it the whole time as a little girl, because she missed it actually so much. Mm. And therefore the sort of colour and the vibrancy and the music was how she made Jamaica sort of part of our lives.
Right.
So that when I went actually back to Jamaica, sadly, when I went, she died by that time. It was as if when I got off the plane, I was going home. I had that real sense of familiarity and instant empathy with this country.
And tell me more about your mum then. What was her story?
As with many Jamaicans, left Jamaica to go to North America to work. So her brothers and her, and indeed her mum, would go and work in particularly New York, and they'd go back to Jamaica always for their family holidays. She was a seamstress, but then became a house model. So she was one of the very first black women to become a house model. And there are these absolutely stunning pictures of my mum in almost like a Grace Kelly gown.
This was the 40s.
This is the 40s.
So pioneering stuff.
Really pioneering. Oh, you know, segregation. I mean, this was, you know, she would go and model the clothes and then you would leave by another exit from the building. You know, we forget now how segregated that whole environment was. You know, you were in Harlem, you wouldn't, the only white singer, and I always remember my mum telling me this, that would come into the black clubs was Frank Sinatra, and she loved Frank Sinatra because of it. But otherwise, it was an absolute divide.
It must have been, I mean, as much as she had the challenges of living in a segregated world that was prejudiced against her, it does sound like a very fascinating life and a vibrant time. Mm. Why did she go back then to Jamaica?
She went back to Jamaica because that's where her cousins, grandparents were. She was probably by this point 30, which was quite old in those days to be married. And she met my dad, who had stayed on in the army after the Second World War, and they got married after 6 weeks. Then very quickly she had both myself and my sister, and she was very happy because she was back with her family in Jamaica. She had us two girls, and then she comes to the grey and bleak landscape of the Medway towns, and that was pretty grim.
Let's have some music. What's next?
Well, this is a real anthem for my mum. This is Diana Washington. We would play on, you know, the old record player, lots of music of Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday. But Diana Washington was somebody who never quite had the profile, actually, even now, that some of those other great singers enjoy. But I think she's just got the most magnificent voice.
That was Diana Washington and You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You. So, Heather Robatz, we haven't even really mentioned your dad, apart from the fact that he married your mother. What was your dad like?
My dad was a very quiet, quite shy man. You couldn't have picked two more opposite characters. He'd been brought up in Bermondsey, and he came from a very poor background, left school at a young age, but then went to evening classes. And it was probably only after my mother died that my dad and I got close, really. But he always backed me. He was always the person who said, no, if that's what you want to
do. Like what?
You know, when I left school and came to London, that was, you know, at 16. That was not an easy moment back at home, but I really couldn't take school anymore. And the deal was, well, if you come to London, you're going to have to try and get back into education, but you need to work and support yourself. But he understood why, for me, leaving school was just, I had to be out of that environment.
Yes, now here's a confusion to me, because, you know, as I've said, a barrister and indeed all the things you've gone on to achieve at a very high level. How come you left school with just two O-levels?
I failed my 11 plus, you know, it was at that time in the education system. And
how come?
I just couldn't do those tests. And I suppose by that point, I was already struggling with issues around my identity. And I just found school difficult. You know, at that time, there were no other, you know, kids from any other backgrounds but English backgrounds.
Were you treated differently?
Yes. I mean, I was a curiosity for some. I mean, I made friends. So again, I wouldn't want to sort of label everybody. But you were, you know, it was a time where you would be called monkey and half-breed and those sorts of names. And I think at times, you know, as we know, children can be very cruel without realising it. I think they thought it was a slight joke. They didn't realise how hurt it made me feel. But it was a very lonely place. And I think that as a consequence, my educational performance suffered.
Yeah. When you were being called those repugnant names in the schoolyard and so on, did you go home and talk to your mother about it, or did you feel that was to burden her?
Yeah, no, I very rarely told her, because she was going through her own traumas about being very isolated, and as a consequence, you know, suffered from depression for many years. And I would go home and try and make her feel better.
Do you think she felt that she'd made a mistake coming to Britain?
Yes, she always wanted to go home. I can remember sort of making plans with her, you know, a six-year-old. Well, if we did this and saved this amount of money, Mum, we can go back. She'd been this incredibly independent woman. I mean, she'd earned her own living. And she used to say to me, make sure you always have your own knicker money.
That's money tucked in your drawers.
Yes. Despite how much I love my husband, I've always had a sense of my own bank accounts, my own independence, my own financial security. That stayed with me my entire life.
Let's have some more music. We're on disc four.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's Bob Marley. Natural Mystic is this lovely track. There are very few musicians which, you know, one's sons like at the same way as you do. But Bob Marley is a sort of family hero figure, and it's quite a spiritual song, and so I think I'll listen to some Marley.
There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. If you listen carefully now, you will hear. This could be the first trumpet.
That was Bob Marley and Natural Mystic. So, Heather Rabatz, being a chief executive can be a very lonely place. Do you think that you are well prepared in that respect, that you know how it feels to stand on your own in the middle of, be at the playground or be at the boardroom? You're used to that feeling and you can cope with it.
I think that's probably right. I think it is about being respected. You know, you are both in a team, working with teams, but you're never of the team, because you might the next day have to call one of them in and say, no more.
Well, it is often that key teacher, the one person that recognises something that everybody else fails to recognise. That happened to you when?
When I came to London, I went to a further education college and I met my first black teacher, a guy called Max Johnson. It was one of those sort of, you know, enrolment days.
Right.
And I think he probably saw a slightly lost soul and he had me sign up for his A-level, and thankfully Max got me to do my A-levels.
So you got your A-levels and you made it to the LSE, and after that you trained as a barrister. You know, a lot of people decry the idea that people from ethnic backgrounds are given opportunities that they might not otherwise be, that there is a sense of course, positive discrimination is the phrase. Do you believe in that?
I don't believe in positive discrimination. What I believe is in ensuring that talent, be it black talent, female talent, has the opportunity to rise and achieve their potential. And unless you make positive interventions to enable those issues of diversity to be addressed in organisations, it will not happen.
But what does that mean then? If it's not quotas, what does it mean? Is it just an atmosphere within a building? Can it be as sort of nebulous as that?
It's partly atmosphere. It's partly about the signals you send out as a leader of an organisation. When I was in Lambeth, Nelson Mandela came on a royal visit. The first person he spoke to when he came out the car was the black security guard who stood on the bottom of the step. And all the great and the good, with all their medals, stood in and waited. In that instant, he conveyed something beyond any words about actually how we are all important in terms of what we do. And then it is about, when I was in football, and we're not having sacked a manager, we used to get all these applicants from these guys saying, I've just taken Luton to the top of the European Championship. And I would think, well, I know my football knowledge is not great, but I'm sure Luton have never gone to the European Championship. And you read down their application, it's because they spent all their time on Football Manager on a PlayStation, and they thought that equipped them to apply for managerial jobs. And actually, if you talk to women, I say, why aren't you applying for this job? Oh, I can't do that, Heather. You talk to a guy and they've done hardly anything and they will instantly believe that they can apply for that job. And that, to me, is about encouraging women to say, go for it.
Since you've brought us to the area of dangerous feminist thinking, let's talk about the women of Greenham Common, who you represented as a barrister. You went to visit them.
I did. And I used to visit them in the mud, of course, in my heels. They were all in Wellingtons and they were knitting for peace. I mean, they looked at me in utter despair. I've obviously been a very strong supporter of women's rights from my earliest memory, but I would be slightly irritated with this sort of knitting for peace. But hey, look, it was amazing. It was amazing that these women left their homes, they took their kids to campaign for nuclear disarmament. So a cause I absolutely felt very strongly about myself, but I can't say that I felt a great bonding with the Greenham women, nor they with me.
Let's have some music then, Heather Rabatz.
We're going to hear Joan Sutherland, just a soaring, soaring, soaring voice. And this is her singing from Norma Castadiva.
Joan Sutherland singing Castadiva from Bellini's Norma. Do you watch The Apprentice?
I have watched The Apprentice.
Do you think, Sir Alan, I wouldn't do it like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, I understand why it works on television terms, but would you want to be managed in that sort of way, with that sort of level of aggression and hostility? I mean, it is a sort of a management way of doing things that is obviously way past its sell-by date. And I'm sure Sir Alan actually, in reality, doesn't work like that at all. It's sort of great popular television, but that's not real life.
So, Heather Rabatz, you had married young. You'd married your college sweetheart. Mm. When did you have your child?
I had my son in 1983.
Oh, gosh. And what was happening in your working life at that point?
I was a barrister in chambers. In fact, I was told if you don't really try now, you're not going to be able to have a child, because I don't think I'm naturally maternal. And I was at home with my son for the first sort of 18 months before he then went to nursery. And I took a six-month job at that point working for a local government campaign team and sort of fell into the world of local government.
You don't think you're naturally maternal?
I don't think so. You have to talk to my son and my stepson. I used to go to those, you know, mum and toddler groups. And I just found all of that just beyond me, really. No, I think, have I been a good mother? I have tried. I think I've got better at it as he's got older. I was the youngest chief exec in the country, at 31 years old. And, you know, they were long hours. And so there was quite a lot that I missed. And I look back at that with some regret. I always say to women, actually, it's very difficult to, you know, be there at home, doing the bedtime stories and run big, complex organisations.
So that's what you say to women. What do you say to Ewan? Did you have conversations with him?
I have had conversations with him as he's got older, and partly about my own sense of regret. And, of course, I adore him and think he's wonderful. But he said to me, but, you know, Mum, how do you think I've turned out? And I said, well, you know, I think you've turned out as a pretty lovely young man. He said, well, that then actually it all worked out, didn't it? And he doesn't look back and think, well, you know, my mum didn't read me the bedtime story. For big moments in his life or whenever there was issues, I was absolutely, you know, I'd be out that office door faster than, you know, Roadrunner. And so those are the moments he remembers.
Let's have some music, Heather.
Well, this is an anthem to me and my women mates, you know, and it is when the going gets tough. When the going gets tough, actually, you go round to your friends and you put on your high heel shoes and you have a glass and you blast Tina Turner, Simply the Best.
Tina Turner and Simply the Best for you, Heather Abatz, and your girlfriends when the going gets tough. You put that on the CD player. So you applied for the job, as I said, that was described as probably the worst job in local government. And you have since said that the only thing wrong about that phrase was the probably bit. Tell me why on earth you decided to apply for the post.
Well, there's a saying that it's better to live one day as a tiger than 100 days as a sheep. At the time, there were many people who said, don't go and do this. This will ruin your career.
Yes, I mean, Lambeth was the original rotten borough, just to remind people.
I mean, it was totally dysfunctional. I mean, it didn't collect council tax. Virtually all of the schools were about to go into special measures, hadn't reconciled our accounts for 18 years, which is, you know, 900 million turnover. I mean, it's a big entity. And just, it was like nothing worked. Nothing worked. There were moments when I really would lie awake thinking, what have I done?
Yes, and so what, in your own head, what was the standard that you were setting yourself to say, well, yes, at least I know I've made a difference? Was there one important thing that you thought you had to change, or was it not as simple as that?
For me, it was about actually getting Lambeth out of the news. It was about it becoming a normal and functioning organisation, and that was the five-year plan. But I thought, if we can shine a light in one little area, it will start to make things happen. And the one area was that we used to have estate lights, and the lights would be on all day for 3 years and off all night for 3 years. And I got one guy and 60,000 light bulbs and probably broke every rule there was about how you procure these things. I said, just mend the lights on the estates and it will win us time to sort out a huge amount of complexity behind. In that one simple moment, people started thinking, actually, maybe this time it can work.
Running a business, of course, would be pretty straightforward if it weren't for the customers and the staff. It's the mercurial nature of us humans that makes it tricky. What have been your trickiest moments in dealing with when the stuff really hits the fan?
I think you're absolutely right that the art of management and leadership is understanding that people come to work bringing their hopes and dreams and fears and insecurities. And that's why you can't manage people as if they're all in boxes. You know, when I went to Millwall, that was really tricky. It was tricky because of the brand and reputation. It was tricky because at that time, financially, it was going through a real crisis. And it was a family. You know, the people who work in Millwall are like a family. They've been there for years. They're absolutely dedicated and committed.
And this was a brand and a reputation that was synonymous with not just violence from the fans, but racist violence, racist chants from the fans.
Absolutely. And I've always felt that wherever you go, you talk to people. And I did my first fans forum, and there must have been about, I don't know, 500 people. And I could see that people were slightly worried on my behalf. And this guy must have been, I don't know, felt 6'5", huge bloke, came up to me and he said, have you got anything against white working class people? And I said, absolutely not. You know, my dad came from round the corner from here. He just had the very good sense to marry a Jamaican woman. Have you got a problem with that? And he went, Well, actually, ever? No, probably I haven't. And I think, you know, it's about standing your ground. And actually, of course, most of those people there were absolutely fantastic and fine. There were, of course, a couple of people who, you know, I would say were unacceptable in terms of their views that were held. But what's really important is that the people in the room turn on them and say, that's unacceptable. That's where you have to get to.
So you were at Millwall for 4 years, and then when you're now at the Royal Opera House. So going from, yes, I'm glad you laugh. So going from the terraces to the dress circle, which do you prefer?
Oh, you know what? I think life is about living on both sides of that road. But, you know, how you deal with talent, how you deal with agents, how do you respond to your loyal ticket supporters but then want to vary ticket prices to get more people and different people through the doors? How do you become more inclusive? You'd be surprised. I often draw on my Millwall experience round the table at the Opera House.
Let's have some music, Heather.
Well, this is a piece of music that I was introduced to actually by my husband, who has a real eclectic music taste. But it's Rai Kuda and Ali Fakaturi, and it's this great combination of African voice and electric guitar.
That was Rai Kuda and Ali Farkature and Bond. So you're married now for the second time. Did your husband prefer coming to see Millwall or going to see the opera?
He doesn't like the opera. Doesn't like the opera. Yes, he's more football than opera, although he's a lover of music, but not quite the style of the Opera House yet.
And what about your sons? Because you have a stepson.
I have a stepson, yes. I have a stepson, Alex, who's just finishing his A-levels. And what's been great between my stepson and my son, although there's 10 years difference in age, is that they have become brothers and they do take care of each other. And that, for me, feels very important, that, you know, when I'm no longer here, I will have a sense that for Alex and Ewan, whenever they're in trouble, they always talk to each other. And that's lovely.
You mentioned that you got to know your father a lot better after your mother died. Mm. What did he make of this incredible journey that your life has been to date?
I think he felt very proud of me. I think he was sort of bemused, really, that how this slightly wayward girl had ended up in these weird and wonderful places. The great thing about my parents, with all the difficulties and challenges that had gone on between them, is that they always were really supportive. They were always supportive. And when you lose both of your parents, I think you do feel that sense of, gosh, time to grow up. I have much more that sense of one's by oneself, despite having great family and friends. It's different. It's different.
Your mother, of course, had lived to see a good degree of your success.
Yes, yes.
Do you think, given that life that she left behind in New York, did she take possibly a different sort of pleasure in the vibrancy of your own life?
I think for my mum, it was a bit of living vicariously through me. She would keep all the clippings and I would try and share those moments. You know, she had got herself into quite a difficult and dark place. So it was the sort of shining a light back into the world and sort of say to her, look, whatever you feel about what's happened in your life, you know, actually, I have gone on to do all these things, and not least because of you.
Let's have your final piece then, Heather.
Well, I think having some choral music and having a sense of one's own small part in this great universe of ours. And so it's Jan Garbarek and the Hilliard Ensemble. So choral music with a wonderful saxophone.
That was Jan Gabarek with the Hilliard Ensemble and the opening of Officium. So, Heather, It's the books now, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, And what?
I'm a bit of an insomniac, so I read about, I don't know, two or three books simultaneously, but I usually always have a classic by the bed. And so I'm going to have the book that I've probably now read 110 times, but I can always reread. It will be Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
And your luxury?
I'm not allowed to take my spaniel, am I? My little dog. No, I know. I will take, therefore, a sort of solar-powered digital photograph album. So then I can look at all the pictures of all these wonderful people that I've known in my life.
OK, Heather, that's yours. Andy, if you had to pick just one of the 8 discs to save?
I think it would be Karine Bailey-Ray, because it would remind me of today, but has this great song about wherever life will take you.
OK, que sera, sera is yours. Heather Robatz, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.